Hello and welcome to another episode of Battleground with me, Patrick Bishop, and Saul David. Well, the least surprising news of recent days is Vladimir Putin's victory in the Russian presidential elections. He scraped home with a mere 87% of the vote, thus confounding predictions that he would only manage 75%. The result was an impressive demonstration not of his popularity, but of the efficiency of the machine of repression he's built up in nearly a quarter of a century in power. But it's easy to be dismissive of the outcome. How much support is actually genuine, we'll be asking. How solid are the foundations of Putin's rule?
Emboldened, perhaps, by the results, Putin's men lost no time in issuing new threats to the West, and in particular to President Emmanuel Macron of France, who has emerged in recent weeks as the most belligerent Western leader by hinting strongly that he is willing to send French troops to Ukraine. Russia's chief of foreign intelligence, Sergei Naryshkin, warned that if French troops do appear on the battlefield, they will become, and I quote, a primary and legitimate target. When Putin was asked about Macron's remarks in a post-election press conference, he replied, "It is clear to everyone that this will be one step away from a full-scale World War III. I think hardly anyone is interested in this." However, perhaps in the warm afterglow of victory, he then added a bit more benignly that he wished Macron would stop seeking to aggravate the war in Ukraine, but play a role in finding peace. "It seems that France could play a role. All is not lost yet," said Putin. Intriguingly, he claimed that Russian electronic eavesdropping had picked up both French and English being spoken on the battlefield. If true, that could be anyone, of course, members of volunteer units, for example. But what do we actually know about this, Patrick? I mean, there is some indication that NATO has a military presence in Ukraine in the form of advisors, but is there more to it than that?
I don't think there is at the moment, Saul. About a year ago, there's pretty good intelligence that there were nearly 100 special forces from NATO countries operating in Ukraine. And this is from leaked US intelligence files, which saw the light of day back in April 2023. Now, according to these files, which were regarded as pretty kosher, US officials assessed that there were 97 special forces from NATO countries active in Ukraine, of which the vast majority, 50, were British. So, you know, a great deal more than those from the US and France, which were said to have deployed 14 and 15 special forces members, respectively. It's not clear from the leaked documents whether those 50 Brits were exclusively, you know, top-level SF, you know, SAS, SBS, etc. There could have been Royal Marines, paras, etc. in the mix. But there's also good evidence from that leaked conversation, listeners will remember, from between German commanders talking about events in Ukraine, which the Russians intercepted and then published. And now the General Ingo Gerhardt, who's the head of the Luftwaffe, essentially, was telling one of his colleagues how the UK and Ukraine worked together to deploy Storm Shadow missiles against targets behind Russian lines. And he said, "When it comes to mission planning, I know how the English do it. They do it completely in reach back. They also have a few people on the ground." So reach back, I assume he means they're talking to Brits back in the UK. But he went on, "They also have a few people on the ground." But he went on to say that the French don't. So the Brits are really the most forward, I would say, of the NATO allies in Ukraine at the moment. But that's not the same thing as having actual boots on the ground. So I don't think there are any, despite what Putin is saying, what Russian propaganda is saying, that there are actual soldiers actively taking part in the fighting. They're there as advisors in that kind of capacity, and very small numbers if those reports are true. But let's get back to that Putin victory. So what have you learned from listening to the post-election mood music?
Well, it's very telling, I think, that almost the first thing Putin did was address the FSB, the Federal Security Service, and the successor, of course, to the original KGB, which he led before entering politics. He lauded them as a key guarantor of Russian security and sovereignty. Now, the clear message here is that the Russian security services and the Siloviki, the securocrats who guarantee his grip on power, will continue to represent his core constituency in his fifth presidential term. And this, at least, is the verdict of the Institute for the Study of War, who've analysed the speech. In it, he praised the FSB officers for, as I say, ensuring Russian security and sovereignty. He thanked them for successful operations in Ukraine. We're not exactly sure what they've done in Ukraine. I mean, I can't imagine they're on the front line there, Patrick, but let's just go with that. And for suppressing attempts to interfere in Russian internal affairs and for repelling terrorist attacks against Russia. And this presumably is a reference to the limited raids by all Russian pro-Ukrainian volunteers in Kursk and the Belgorod Oblast. But again, you wonder to what extent FSB officers are actually involved in combating these guys, but they're getting the credit nonetheless. Now, Putin obviously needs these guys. Remember, it was a former member of the Securocrats, Yevgeny Prigozhin and his Wagner group, who thus far presented the biggest threat to his power. So this was an indication to Russia and Russians that he has their back and they have his. So I would read this as a recipe for a further tightening of state oppression to stifle what little opposition remains.
Yes, it seems that the security establishment and Putin are very much invested in each other, aren't they? I was struck by a very apt line by Sky News' Diana Magne the other day, who called what the security forces are doing as performative loyalty. There's fierce competition among the Kremlin toadies to outdo each other in proposing new repressive measures to please their master. Now, this is what Alan Phillips was talking about last week. But is repression going to be enough, I wonder? I mean, basically, we've always got to remember the underlying picture for Putin and his regime is pretty bleak in the long run. And the question, as always, for Ukraine is whether the erosion that's eating away at the underpinnings of Putin's rule will bring the whole edifice tumbling down in time to save them. Now, James, our producer, was at a high-level security briefing the other day, which revealed some facts that don't seem to have been properly picked up. Now, one of them that was very striking was the effect that the ongoing Ukrainian attacks on Russian oil facilities are having on Russian oil production. So Russia's actually introduced a six-month ban on gasoline exports. And this is a direct result of the decreased output at refineries due to the damage being done by missile and drone strikes. This is thought to be a measure to stabilize domestic consumption, but it will obviously have an impact on exports and therefore on Russia's, given the vital place that energy has in the Russian economy, the Ukrainian strategy of targeting oil and gas is clearly a good one. So this is going to impact politics in time, as surely will be the ongoing staggering attrition rate. This briefing revealed that although Russia has scaled back on its ongoing low-level offensive, even so, in February, Russian losses were running at 983 a day, dead and wounded, that is. Now, that's a very big number with pretty much nothing to show for it. Now, we all know the Russians' ability to absorb pain is legendary, but even they must have limits. Wouldn't you say so, Saul?
Well, you would have thought so, though history might suggest something different, Patrick, as we've no doubt mentioned. I mean, in World War II, the figures are staggering, really. Russia suffers 27 million deaths, including almost 9 million servicemen. And yet there's no serious opposition to Stalin's pretty brutal rule. And the soldiers, to the end, as we know, keep fighting. What's different this time, though, as I've said before, is that Russia is not being propped up economically by the US and the West. In fact, the opposite is true. And in the long run, and maybe it won't even need the US to stay solid behind Ukraine in this calculation, this is going to make a vital difference. So the Ukrainians are absolutely right to target aspects of Russia's economy, in particular the oil industry. But just to go back to the situation on the battlefield, it appears that although the Russians are pushing forward on what the security officials describe as multiple axes, the number of attacks this month is down by 13% compared with February. Not quite sure exactly how they compute that, but the picture is clear. Any further progress after taking Avdiivka is going to be increasingly problematical, as again, according to these officials, Ukraine has been engaged in a vigorous strengthening of defensive positions. So the boot's really on the other foot now, isn't it, Patrick? To make real progress, the Russians will face pretty much the same difficulties that the Ukrainians did last summer. And given their tactics to date, this will result in enormous casualties. Now, you can sense their frustration in the sort of hybrid warfare tactics they have resorted to off the battlefield in recent weeks. I'm thinking about the cyber attack on the aircraft of the British Defence Secretary, Grant Shapps, when his RAF jet was returning to the UK from Poland where Shapps had been visiting British troops earlier this month. We asked our resident electronic warfare expert, the excellent David Alexander, what exactly was behind the attack. And he's of the opinion that the attack on the Dassault Falcon's GPS system was launched from Kaliningrad, the Russian Baltic enclave on the northern border of Poland, which the Russians have been using for such activities for some time.
So David writes, it has become more active recently, which is probably a Teddy's out of the pram response to Finland and Sweden joining NATO, which means the Baltic Sea has become a NATO lake through which the Russians have to sail to reach St. Petersburg and the surrounding coastline at the far end. He goes on, we've previously discussed the fact that the Russians use GPS jamming in Ukraine. By broadcasting a strong signal on the same frequency as the GPS system, the Russians can either stop the receipt of GPS signals altogether or subtly alter it to make the receiver think it's in a different place to where it actually is. GPS jamming affects the accuracy of weapon systems such as HIMARS, Storm Shadow, Excalibur-guided 155mm shells, and other systems using GPS. The Russians can do this because they have their own equivalent sat-nav system known as GLONASS. So jamming GPS doesn't affect their own guidance and navigation capability. He goes on, GPS jamming will also affect aerial navigation for all civil aviation and anything from a NATO air force, including this RAF transport aircraft that Grant Shapps was traveling in. But he ends on a reassuring note. It should be noted that the jamming is nothing more than a minor inconvenience for any good pilot. So Grant Shapps wasn't in any great danger there. So it's more of a nuisance thing than anything else.
Yeah, and he also noted his fascinating message from us, and we've missed hearing from David in recent weeks because he's been a little bit under the weather, to say the least. I won't go into details, but there are various reasons why we haven't heard from David. So it's much appreciated that he's back in touch. But he also notes in his message that Russia has greatly increased the number of cyber attacks on the French state in response to President Macron's increasingly hard line stand against Putin. The French government said on Monday that several of its services had been targeted by cyber attacks of unprecedented intensity, and a special crisis center was activated to restore online services. Prime Minister Gabriel Attal's office said in a statement that the attacks started Sunday night and hit multiple government ministries without providing details. By Monday afternoon, it said, the impact of the attacks has been reduced for most services and access to government sites restored. Patrick, you've heard a little bit more about this, haven't you?
Yeah, well, apparently this was attributed to a group of hackers called Anonymous Sudan, which is considered by cybersecurity experts as pro-Russian, and they indeed claimed responsibility for the attacks in online posts. There wasn't any comment from the French Prime Minister's office on what was targeted or what damage might have been caused. But it was probably denial of service attack, so-called. This is a common type of cyber attack, which involves flooding a site with data in order to overwhelm it. You know, David's first thought was that this was actually a pretty stupid tactic on the part of the Russians. He said it was a bit like Hitler diverting his bombers to attack London at the height of the Battle of Britain. That's a reference to the fact they switched away from, the Luftwaffe switched away from attacking the fighter command airfields and command and control centers to bomb London instead, just when they had fighter command in a pretty tight corner. I don't think it would have been the end, but it certainly would have made winning the Battle of Britain more difficult. Anyway, David says it's a big mistake to divert cyber resources that would otherwise probably have been attacking Ukraine in the ongoing cyber war there. Russia, he reckons, has a finite cyber warfare capacity, and devoting time to attacking France when it could be attacking Ukraine was a mistake. So it gives Ukraine, in effect, a kind of respite, not a cessation, but a reduction in intensity and the number of targets, which can only be good for them.
Now, as you know, we, particularly I, but we more generally like to accentuate the positive on battleground. So it's good to see that Ukraine's European partners are pursuing an initiative which has been much talked about and which would greatly increase Kyiv's ability to carry on resisting. Bloomberg reported earlier this week that the European Union has prepared draft legislation that would allow the transfer of profits from frozen Russian assets to Ukraine as early as summer this year. So what figures are we talking about here, Patrick? Well, they've done the number crunching and they reckon that the profits, they're not taking the capital, but they're just taking the revenue from the capital. And that would come up to a staggering 2.5 to 3 billion euros a year. And obviously that's going to be very handy for the Ukrainians. Now, the Polish Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for National Defense, Kosiniak-Kamysz, additionally announced on March 18 that Germany and Poland are creating a, and I quote, armored vehicle coalition to support Ukraine, and noted that Sweden, the UK and Italy have already declared their willingness to join that coalition. What that actually means, we don't have the details for yet, but it seems another step in the right direction.
Okay, that's it for part one. Do join us after the break when we'll be hearing from Johnny O'Reilly, an Irish filmmaker who's made a remarkable film about Kherson. And of course, we'll be answering all your questions.
Welcome back. Well, I think many listeners will be aware that just over a week ago, the feature-length documentary at the Oscars was won by a Ukrainian for the first time, who made the harrowing and unbelievably powerful film 20 Days in Mariupol. Well, we're about to talk to an Irish filmmaker, Johnny O'Reilly, based in Kyiv, who's making another feature-length documentary that could be just as powerful. It's called Kherson. It's got an amazing team behind it, including the producer of the Oscar-winning One Day in September and Searching for Sugar Man. And we spoke to Johnny O'Reilly about the making of this film. Johnny, welcome to the podcast.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely fascinating and gripping project you have in hand, a full-length documentary feature on Kherson. We've spoken a lot about the city, of course, on the podcast over the last 18 months, 2 years. How did the idea for you making a feature on it come about?
Well, when the war started, I had a feature film in development that was about to get going. But, the events of Feb 24-22 put an end to that. And I had worked sporadically as a journalist in the past. So the most useful thing for me to do at that point was to stay put, stay in Ukraine and work as a journalist. So for about 6 months, I spent my time touring the front lines and in Kyiv, where I live and have lived for 5 years, writing about the war, but always with the view to looking for an interesting subject as a documentary. And I wrote about a priest who was also a fighter with the 124th Brigade, the Terra Barona in Kherson, who was living under Russian occupation. And he was hiding from the Russians, who were actively looking for people like him in the city. And when the article came out, we became friends and I checked in with him from time to time. I sent him a bit of money. And a point came where it was more dangerous for him to stay in the city than to risk the very dangerous journey of leaving. And he asked me to help him. So I basically paid for a boat driver to take him and two of his Terra Barona colleagues out from the city at night past Russian positions and successfully return to Ukrainian-held territory. So he rejoined his brigade in this very bucolic, beautiful children's camp in the middle of Ukraine, where he and 600 of his fellow Khersonians were all getting trained up as professional soldiers to what we thought at the time was prepare for the biggest battle, the most important battle of the war, the Stalingrad of the war, if you like, to liberate their home city of Kherson. And they invited me down to that secret base. And I was given amazing access, much more so than any other journalist would have gotten. They kind of treated me to a bit of a hero's welcome because I had helped their comrades escape the city. And I recognized immediately what a great opportunity for a documentary. You know, here were 600 people, mostly non-soldiers, who were getting trained up to retake their city, which at the time was under occupation. And they were all on their phones to their loved ones, you know, trying to extricate useful information from them about the whereabouts and movements of Russians inside the city. So I started filming them. I selected a couple of characters And now, a year and a half later, I'm still filming them. But we're coming to the end of the story, and we will be editing the film this year and delivering it towards the end of the year.
Tell me a little bit about the narrative arc of the film. I mean, we obviously know from having, or people listening to the podcast will know from having followed the war pretty much from the start, that Kherson has a pretty unique story, really, doesn't it? In the sense that it was occupied, of course, at the beginning and then freed from occupation. So how does the narrative arc of the feature work in terms of what we know so far and also where we're going? Because presumably, well, we all know the story's not yet over.
Yeah, the story's not yet over. So the arc hasn't really completed and, you know, showed the full clear shape of how it's going to look. But there are a few important plot points along the way. The first obviously being the battle for the city and the occupation of it on the 1st of March, I believe. So it was literally just about 4 or 5 days after they rolled into town. They fully occupied the city and the front lines moved towards Mykolaiv, which is another similar sized city, just about 100 miles to the west of Kherson. And for much of the first six to eight months of the war, there was a battle in and around Mykolaiv. Then towards September, the Russians were pushed back to small towns between Mykolaiv and Kherson. And then ultimately on November the 11th, the city was liberated after the Russian forces were pushed back to the left bank, to where they essentially are remain now. So the first segment of the documentary will be, you know, kind of like a parallel narrative of life for some of my characters who were under occupation in that 9 month period from February to November in 2022. Simultaneous to that, their families, the men in their family who had escaped the city are getting trained up to essentially retake the city. Then once the two sides were reunified inside the city after liberation, there's a short period of celebration followed by the start of attacks on the city. That happened mid to late November, and to this day has remained pretty much the same. So right now there are artillery, shahids, you know, large and small ammunition constantly on an hourly basis hitting Kherson outskirts and often the city center. So the people who remain there have been living under a constant artillery barrage since liberation almost a year and a half ago.
Johnny, there's an extraordinary cast of characters. I think you've mentioned one, that's Maxim, the Orthodox priest. Tell us about some of the others. I'll just rattle off a couple. Valik, a 20-year-old former partisan who now serves in Ukrainian special forces. And my two favorite characters, I think, because I suspect they will be for a lot of people if you can have favorite characters in a film such as this. And that's Olena and Valentin, who defy the Russians during the occupation and, of course, are now living in so-called occupied Kherson. But as you say, it's still a pretty horrific place to live. And also featured in a small extract of the film I've seen, beautifully shot, very moving, but you know, it's going to be absolutely stunning. I mean, the photography that I've seen is really fabulous. But this, of course, is the story of the flood after the pretty cynical blowing up of the Kokhova Dam and the consequences that had. I mean, we reported it on the podcast, but actually seeing the effects in real life, so to speak. But these two, Olena and Valentin, maybe just start with them. Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, most of the characters in the film are clustered around this family unit, at the center of which are Olena and Valentin, both in their 60s. Both have lived in the Neftegavan area of South Kherson. This is the area that is facing the delta, which is mostly a gray zone, but on the other side of the delta are the Russian forces. So they're their home is right on the front lines. So we started filming them as soon as liberation took place, and we pretty much embedded with them for much of the last year and a half. They are amazing characters. They're community leaders, ex-business. They ran quite a successful business, a fish business, of, you know, just collecting fish from local fishermen and packaging it and selling it to for export. So they moved, you know, they became the leaders of the local partisan movement under occupation. So they were responsible for some very successful HIMARS attacks within the city when information came through them from people in the community. When liberation took place, they refused to leave their homes because they didn't want to abandon their community. And this is something that you find a lot at front lines across the 1,000 kilometer long front line in Ukraine, that people, particularly older people, refuse to leave until the very last moment. And one of the themes of the documentary that we're making really is this humanity at the edge. You know, why is it that people will make such a sacrifice just to maintain personal connections with their neighbors, you know? But what happens at these communities is people come together like family. You know, they demonstrate to each other that they're willing to live and die for each other. And that creates extremely human, extremely strong bonds that become unshakable in the face of the adversity that they've all faced. So Olena and Valentin are very kind of larger than life, very funny. He is very gruff and taciturn, but has a very dark sense of humor. She's very emotional, given to, you know, a lot of laughter, a lot of crying, spontaneously breaking into song and poetry. But they're both fierce patriots and believe very much in the cause that they're sacrificing for. Their son is a Shturmovik. He is doing some of the most dangerous work in the army, storming Russian positions in the Zaporizhia region. And their grandson is doing something similar in Kherson, over on the left bank. So they are amazing characters and really privileged that they have allowed us into their lives and into their communities to really capture up close what life is like in that fairly extraordinary situation.
You've got together, Johnny, I have to say, obviously a pretty decent team to make this film. I mean, your producer is double Oscar-winning John Batsek, who won Academy Awards for two films I saw a fair while ago. Well, One Day in September, a long time ago. More recently, Searching for Sugar Man. You're definitely getting the A-team together, but you still need a little bit of funding. I think, looking at the document, $250,000 out of a total budget of just under $1 million. If anyone listening to this podcast is interested in getting involved, what's the sort of minimum amount you would consider taking in investment? How do they get in touch with you? And what's the possible reward for that?
Well, thank you very much for offering this and for advocating on behalf of the project. It's not quite crowdsourcing or direct investment, but using podcasts to raise finance. I'm very grateful for that. So thank you. Yeah, we're looking for $250,000. We've got a slightly unique business model in that we have some public subsidy, but only the public subsidy that is recoupable at a very weak position. Most European movies or arthouse films are funded through the public subsidy where they have done pre-sales and it's not really for profit. But with John Batsek involved, we believe that we've got a good chance to make this project profitable because of his relationship with the big four, or it's five, I guess now, platforms. So we've presented the film to Netflix. They like it and they're tracking it. But obviously, only when the movie is finished can we really get a sale from some of the big platforms. So the minimum we're accepting is $50,000. If we can get five investors at 50K or, you know, anything less than that, we'd be delighted. And people can contact me by email or by phone. I can give you my email address now if you like. So whatever suits you.
Yeah, and we'll put it in the program notes. So if anyone doesn't actually catch it when we do the program, then they can get in touch from there. Well, Johnny, it sounds like an absolutely fantastic project. I know it's going to be an incredibly moving film. And we've just had the Mariupol film out and you can see the level of interest there's been in that. And I think this is going to be just the same. From what I've seen, as I say, looks absolutely fabulous. So great job. Best of luck with completing it. And I look forward to seeing the finished product.
Great. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Well, that sounds like a terrific project. It's not quite finished yet, it has to be said. They've got a lot of the material in the bag, but they're not quite over the line yet, and they're actually looking for some extra funding. So if anyone's looking to invest in a good cause, here it is.
So if you want to get in touch with Johnny and discuss the film and possibly interested in funding it, go to info@snapshot-films.com. That's info@snapshot-films.com. And that will also be in the notes for the podcast. Okay, moving on to questions. We've got one here from Tom Fitzherbert in London. Excellent podcast, not to be missed. He writes, remember the history under Stalin's rule is the Holodomor, which occurred between 1932 and 1933. It is estimated that millions of Ukrainians died as a result of the famine, although precise numbers remain a topic of debate. Some estimates suggest that between 3 and 7 million died from starvation. It's widely acknowledged as one of the deadliest famines in history. Putin is not Stalin. However, there is no doubt that Putin will punish the Ukrainians, removing their language, culture, spirit, defiance, and he will steal their technology, business zeal, the breadbasket of Europe, and so much more. Yeah, I should have said that Tom's message is partly a response to the item we had last week about the Pope calling for Ukraine to raise the white flag and negotiate a surrender. And he goes on to say, has the Pope forgotten the history and is he not listening to the news, your podcast? The Ukrainians are fighting for their survival, culture, language and future whilst remembering the past. Your stand was strong. I do think we are not reminded of Ukrainian history, and I have never heard a politician quote it, as I fear they haven't done their research. So no question there, but thanks for that, Tom. Okay, we've got one here from Richard Walker. He's an ex-Royal Marine, and he says, depending on points of view, there is a belief that Putin in the past has allegedly used influences during elections, mainly aiming towards those who are geared for their own political and financial benefit rather than the greater good. What are your thoughts? Do you feel that the stalling in Congress, specifically from the Republicans, are being played by the master monster puppeteer Putin, and could such blunt accusations force the multi-billion dollar aid package through for Ukraine? Any thoughts on that, Patrick?
Yeah, I'm not sure that Putin's actually manipulating these Republicans. I think they've got their own agenda. But there has been some encouraging words on that front, and they came from White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, who was in Ukraine this week. And in Kiev on Wednesday, he said that this, you know, huge, terribly important assistance package that's being blocked by the Republicans for months would get to Ukraine, though he couldn't say how soon. But he did go on to vow that the Biden administration support would continue for as long as Biden is there. Got a question here from Simon Wright, and he's asking if we can shed any light on an interview he heard on Times Radio with someone who'd been on the Kherson left bank of the Dnipro and the fighting there, which I'm going to come on to. He was asking about a request which seems to have come from the Ukrainian MOD for used migrant boats. Now, these are boats which have been used by people smugglers to get illegal immigrants across the channel. And of course, then once they reach Britain, they're then impounded. And the request was, you know, can we have these to aid our cross-river operations to sustain the enclave, the bridgehead that's been built up on the left bank of the Dnipro? Now, well, this is a story we haven't spoken about in some weeks, isn't it, Saul? But basically, the situation's pretty dire there for the Ukrainian forces who have got this beachhead on the east bank of the Dnipro. Basically, swarms of Russian drones have really severely reduced their ability to operate there. So you've got Ukrainian marine units dug in on that east bank, and they're having to shelter underground to escape surveillance and attack. They're still holding on to their positions and may even have actually made a little bit of progress in recent days, according to the latest reports. Now, they're living, there's about 60 to 100 of them. They're living in cellars and basements in and around the ruined village of Kirinki, facing these almost continuous assaults. Now, when night falls, they go out on patrol, but they also evacuate wounded, etc., across the river. And this is where these boats become very important, small boats, inflatables that can move them at speed back to the relative safety of the West Bank. Well, it does seem to be the case that people have been lobbying, whether it's the Ukrainian government or a Ukrainian charity in particular in Britain, asking the British government to hand over these inflatables, these ribs, to the Ukrainians to be put to good use there to sustain that bridgehead. Well, unfortunately, the response from the UK authorities, this was fairly recently, was this is the British Home Office, they said, although we're fully committed to supporting Ukraine in their fight against Putin's illegal war, while also providing a safe and secure haven for those fleeing the conflict, we cannot donate unsafe and dangerous small boats, which will put more lives at risk. Well, I think that's for the Ukrainians to decide, isn't it? About whether I'm sure they could actually patch them up and make them seaworthy or riverworthy. Now, this is actually the initiative, I should mention, came from a volunteer outfit called Mission Ukraine, which has been petitioning the government on this issue.
Unbelievable that health and safety is coming into play here, Patrick, isn't it? You know, don't these civil servants realize that, you know, Ukraine's in a battle for survival? That bridgehead is interesting, though. I mean, we haven't heard much about it. The Russians were certainly suggesting that they were going to wipe it out. That's been their intention. They implied that they had recaptured Krynki at one point, but clearly that has not been the case. So that is still somewhere to watch in the foreseeable future, because, as I think I mentioned last week, Patrick, the Ukrainians are not ruling out counterattacks of their own this year, while obviously the sensible move is just to sit tight, let the Russians come on and degrade them, you know, in rear areas and also much deeper into Russia, of course, where even this week there was another attack on a long-range air base, one that's been hit before, hundreds of miles behind the line. So it's extraordinary the reach they've got with some of their homemade Ukrainian drones. Right, moving on, we got a question from Kate. She says, I love the podcast. It's great to get information about Ukraine from a non-partisan source. Al Jazeera had an article recently about young Indian men being recruited as war helpers, then ultimately ending up on the front lines. They stated that Russia has been recruiting in many poorer Asian countries with high unemployment. Why are the governments of these countries not preventing this or trying to retrieve their citizens? Why hasn't Modi, that's the leader of India, of course, condemned Putin's tactics when it is leading to the slaughter of his own people? Well, it's a very good question. And if you're of a cynical bent, which Patrick and I inevitably are, having covered this war for the last couple of years, and Patrick's covered many others, you might say, well, actually, Modi considers cheap oil to be much more important than the lives of some of his countrymen who, after all, have made their own decision to leave and serve the Russians. So, yeah, it could be a problem if the numbers rise exponentially, but it just shows how utterly cynical the Russians are at bringing in people from wherever, however, and by telling them lies to get them finally to fight in the front line.
Yeah, and I've done a little digging on this, and it looks like Indian and Nepalese men have been recruited by agents who promised them big paychecks to go and fight in Ukraine for Russia. I think they're claiming that they can get £61,675 a month. That's a huge amount of money to these poor guys. In Nepal, the average salary for an unskilled man, if he can get work, is about £50 a month. So I think a number has been put on it of about 2,000 Nepali men have been lured there to find inevitably that it's not an easy way to make a quick buck. I mean, one guy who was interviewed when he actually made it back home, a Nepalese man, told Sky News recently that they received 2 weeks training. Some of his fellow soldiers of fortune had never actually held a gun before. Once in Ukraine, they were, quote, treated like dogs. They were beaten, deprived of food, and shoved into the front line alongside Russian convicts in advance of the Russian regular troops. So they were basically cannon fodder. Now, Nepal has done something about this. It's asked Russia to send back all its nationals serving in the ranks. Well, good luck with that. Just on the Modi front, Saul, you said he's playing a bit of a cynical game here. Well, it's presented otherwise. He says, you know, that India's really offering itself as a peacemaker here, positioning itself as an honest broker in any future negotiations to end the conflict. Modi's actually managed to keep friendly relations with both Putin and Zelensky. Only this week he called Putin to congratulate him on his election victory. But he also spoke to President Zelensky, and meetings are planned with both men in the near future. So he's managed to sit on the fence throughout the war, really, urging the need for dialogue and diplomacy, while, as you say, at the same time, taking full advantage of cheap Russian energy.
History is not going to be kind to Modi in his attitude towards this war. He can talk about keeping in with both sides, but it's incredibly cynical what he's done, and refusing to condemn the invasion in the first place, really, frankly, in the UN was an indication of where his real sympathies lie.
I'd just like to read out this from a UK correspondent. He's given us his name, but he says he'd rather stay anonymous. Now, this is a corrective to a rather unflattering portrait of Russian cruise passengers, which was sent in last week, was it, or the week before, Saul? This was from someone who'd been on a Mediterranean cruise. A lot of the people on board were Russians, and our correspondent found their demeanour rather kind of boorish and off-putting. In this message, we hear that in counter to your previous correspondent's negative experience on his cruise, I was in Turkey in September 2022 in an area popular with Russian tourists. I'd actually expected the worst, loud and proud, wearing Z t-shirts, you know, the war symbol and the like. On the contrary, the mood was very quiet and subdued, with no boorish behavior that I saw, and many of the people we met were in a very somber mood. Perhaps as mobilization had been announced that week and access to cash for Russian cards was being denied without warning by Turkish banks. In contrast, the behavior of our own compatriots on the flight over was boorish and crass, with a C-bomb being dropped by the middle-aged women in front of us with alarming regularity around my toddler-aged children. Well, I think anyone who's been on an EasyJet or Ryanair flight from a UK airport will recognize what our correspondent is talking about. Now, he goes on to say, without revealing his name, for full disclosure, my wife is Russian, and we were there meeting my mother-in-law. I'm a conversational Russian speaker, so I feel qualified to gauge the mood. My family are anti-war, as are the majority of our Russian friends there and overseas. We've also hosted a Ukrainian friend and maintained friendships with Ukrainians. My big takeaway is, and it's a pale analogy, that it's like Brexit, etc., where you are in a bubble of like-minded people and you don't hear often from those outside the bubble. Yeah, well, again, we can all recognize that. Here's hoping for better times sooner rather than later. Yes, well, amen to that. But I think it's good to hear these correctives, isn't it? So we should never fall into the trap of just, you know, characterizing people en masse, you know, making sort of sweeping generalizations about the way people think. And it's another example of the complexities of Russian opinion and, you know, and another measure of how difficult it is for us to gauge it.
Yeah, it's really important that we don't group all Russians as pro-Putin. I mean, an awful lot of people left the country, which we mentioned since the start of our coverage on Ukraine, Patrick, and, you know, they voted with their feet. And one of the long-term consequences of the war for Putin is that he has lost a lot of the brightest and best, the young university-educated, who don't see a future for them in Russia. And that will impact in the longer term, as I say. Right, moving on. Question from Joachim Zander. A question about mobilization or the draft in Ukraine. One listener's question on the 15th of March about lifestyle in Kyiv reminded me of this question I've been asking myself for quite some time and can't get satisfying information about. Why, for many months, aren't Ukrainians starting the mobilization of more soldiers? At the latest, since Zaluzhny's interview in The Economist, there's no doubt on anyone's mind about the necessity for more soldiers, is there? Also, more and more details have emerged which show that it's not only the weapons that would have made a difference for Ukraine last year, but even back then, the number of their troops and their skills, i.e. training, or the lack thereof. Even if a draft of those demanded 500,000 troops were decided upon right now, it would take significant time to organize and then more time to train them well. What on earth are they waiting for? Still discussing the age of entry. Do you think it could even be possible? And here's the interesting thing about Joachim's question, that Zelensky is consciously playing for time here, hoping that indeed NATO troops or troops from a recently talked about alliance of friendly Eastern and Northern European states would step in, thereby saving Ukraine's youth from putting their lives on the line in large numbers. Well, that is a really fascinating question. Now, I'm not into conspiracy theories, Patrick, as you know, but I was having a chat with a very senior British general the other day, who said that the Ukrainian decision to keep the age relatively high, that's 26, 27, I think it is, at the moment for recruits, was a good one. It was very sensible. It was a kind of strategic decision to preserve the youth, you know, the brightest and the best, as it were, in the long term for Ukraine's future. And if he's right, and I'd never really thought of it in those terms, but if he's right, then it could indeed be a deliberate policy to actually, you know, you're playing poker, of course, here, Patrick, if this is the case. But, you know, you get to a situation where Europe in particular, possibly the US, but certainly Europe, see that Ukraine's in danger of losing the war, and it does actually put troops on the ground. I mean, that's what Macron has suggested they might do. So is it a deliberate policy, do you think?
I would be surprised at that. I think possibly the calculation was that the war would be decided sooner than it was, and so you could afford to take that position. But I think Zelensky showed himself to be a pretty shrewd operator. He's made pretty good judgment calls, I think, on what the West will and will not do. And I think it would not be part of his approach thus far to gamble everything on a NATO intervention, which is extremely unlikely, and I think getting more and more unlikely with every passing day, unless there's some really significant change on the battlefield, which doesn't seem to be in the offing at the moment. But it's a very interesting question. And as we've said before, it's a complete reversal of what historically has been the case to date, isn't it, Saul, with, you know, young men between the ages of sort of 18 and 25 that do the fighting, or at least if you look at the Second World War model. And this is actually the reverse of that.
Yeah, and the general did actually. I should mention one other point he made to me, which is that he did agree with me that the younger soldiers tend to be, you know, more aggressive, and therefore you are losing that capability on the battlefield. But he also made the interesting point that from his own experience in Afghanistan, and we know from other conflicts, Patrick, that actually what happens relatively quickly to combat soldiers is there are only so many fights they can be in. So in Afghanistan, for example, while almost all servicemen were keen to get there for the first time, actually taking them out of the line and putting them back in the line again is a problem. And actually, although we've suggested that, you know, a kind of long-term tempo of operations, you need a break from that. You obviously do, you know, to see your family, to, you know, to R&R. But in his experience, that's always a bit of an issue, getting people back into the line and up to, you know, up to the mark again. You know, it's really difficult to keep people in combat for any length of time. They've only got certain number of days that they can, you know, really fight effectively. So it's all, you know, fascinating stuff.
Yeah, that's a very good point, that, Saul. I remember from my experiences in reporting and writing about Afghanistan, it was absolutely the case that if you're a young soldier, you absolutely want to go and do your 6-month tour in Afghanistan. So the first tour is full of enthusiastic people. They want to test themselves. They want to find out what combat is actually like. When they're told after a break back in the UK or elsewhere of a year or more, that they're going back for a second time, there's markedly less enthusiasm. And people did indeed go back for a third time, third tour, 6 months tour, by which time they really are not looking forward to it one bit. So, yeah, it's definitely a case of steeply declining kind of enthusiasm for battle.
Okay, that's all we have time for. Do join us next Wednesday when we'll be talking to Claire Mully about her extraordinary new book, Agent Zoe, who was up to all kinds of death-defying missions in Poland in 1944. And also again on Friday when we'll be covering the latest news from Ukraine and answering listeners' questions. Goodbye.